Hello and welcome to Wealthian. I'm your host, Andrew Brill. We've got some exciting news for you coming up, so sit back, relax, and enjoy the weekly market recap. Weekly market recap is a look back at some of the best moments our guests have shared with us this week. And the exciting news is that we have a conference coming up June 1st. More details to come, but we'll be joining forces with SALT to bring you ways for you to invest wisely and keep and grow your wealth. Now, let's get to the recap. This week on Speak Up, James Lavish spoke about the current state of the economy and how confusing the indicators are and the battle the Fed is facing. He also touched on the state of Bitcoin and the price of gold.
What's relevant right now? You're looking at the economy today. You're saying, okay, this is a trade I would put on right now. This is something I'd be doing with my personal money right now, today, and then based on why. Give us your perspective on the economy and then something actionable that we could do this week.
Yeah, so I think the most important thing that people are confused about the economy right now, right? So you're seeing all kinds of conflicting numbers come in from the CPI to unemployment numbers, and you hear the Fed talking, they're talking about a pivot, you're hearing the Treasury talking. The most important thing is to understand that we are in a battle right now. We're witnessing a battle between the Treasury and really it's the U.S. government's Congress and the Fed, right? So we had inflation that was created by the expansion of money supply. And, you know, and there was, as you know, that there were supply chain issues during the 2020 year and pandemic lockdowns, but that inflation was sought to be battled by the Fed. The Fed has two mandates. They have the mandate of stable prices, which is really just that 2% inflation. We can come back to that. And then they have the mandate of full employment. But they raised rates exponentially in terms of against zero interest rate policy when we were at zero interest rates. They raised them up to over 5%, 5.5% at the top end. So that's supposed to have a contractory kind of influence on the economy. It's supposed to make the economy contract. It disincentivizes loans and for borrowing, and that's the natural state. Meanwhile, up in Congress, we're like you said, we're spending like drunken sailors. It is just out of control how much we're spending. To give people an idea, we have a $2 trillion-plus deficit run rate right now this year, and we are not in a recession. This is unheard of. We are literally spending like no tomorrow. It is pouring liquidity into the markets. Part of that liquidity is coming in the form of all the interest on our debt. We've got $34.6 trillion of debt that we have now on the books. And we're paying $1.1 trillion a year on interest just on that. So that goes into the economy. Then you've got things like the Inflation Reduction Act, which is it spends money on infrastructure and green energy and green projects, and that pours money into the economy. And so you're seeing in the economy, we kind of have two economies in America, right? So we witness some recessions and some contractions. So you're seeing layoffs, 200,000 plus jobs have been lost this year alone. And then on the flip side, you're seeing some expansion and you're seeing the interest, the inflation rate just kind of stuck at 3%. Why is it stuck there? Well, you've got some expansion in areas because of all the spending and the additional liquidity coming into the market versus the contraction of like commercial real estate, for instance, office real estate, we're seeing a major problem there. Well, it's very sensitive to high rates, so that makes sense. So you've got these two things at play. And so what I'm watching really carefully is the bond market and for clues in the bond market of what's going on, because people understand inherently, even if you're not thinking about it, you just understand that if we're running these deficits, if we have this much interest on our debt, and we're expanding on our debt, the only way to manage that is with more inflation. So you're looking for things that will do well with inflation. And if you should have been owning gold through this period, and that is one of the things that I own, and you should be owning Bitcoin. We can talk about more about Bitcoin as an investment in a second, but what I wouldn't be doing is I wouldn't be owning long bonds, not unless it's for a very short trade. What I would be doing is moving my debt exposure all the way up to the near end, to 2 years and shorter, because the only way around this is for higher inflation, which means ultimately higher rates in the longer end, more debt that's going to be issued, and you're going to have bond investors demanding rate premiums at the longer end in order to be compensated for that. And that's just reality. Yeah, well, you have to take a leap of faith when you're in a developed Western country that, especially in the United States, we have the benefit of being the global reserve asset and the global reserve currency in U.S. dollars and treasuries. So we look at Bitcoin. Typically, people in the United States come to Bitcoin as an investment, as a way to make a bunch of money, as, you know, as it's an alternative way to make money. It's just something interesting and out there on the risk curve, right? But if you go to those countries you're talking about, Venezuela, Argentina, Lebanon, Egypt, these people need a place to store their hard-earned money. So you go out to work, you work for this, you get compensated. And if you don't want to spend all that immediately and you want to save that, where do you save it? You can't access US dollars typically out there. They're difficult to get. They're super expensive. So what do you do? Do you just keep it in your currency? Do you keep it in the bolivar? Do you keep it in the peso? No, you want to do something else with it. And so even the IMF put out a report that admitted that Bitcoin is an important tool, a store of value for people in those countries. Why? They don't care about the volatility because they know it's a volatility and asset that's increasing in adoption, which means it's increasing in worth. As opposed to if they put their money in the peso, they know that it's volatile, but it's decreasing down to zero and it will be revalued time and time again. So this is a really important, you know, form of currency, a form of money for them to store their value in. And then secondly, if they want to flee someplace that is oppressive, you know this, you've done a lot of work on this, Anthony, that if you want to leave someplace that's oppressive, how do you do that with cash? How do you do that with gold? You can walk across the border. And I know somebody who has done this with his whole family from Venezuela. He talks about it, how he was able to sell all of their assets, put it into Bitcoin, walk across the border to America, have those, you know, those 12 words in his head, and they took their entire net worth with them. It would not have been possible without Bitcoin. So it's a different mindset, and it's going to grow kind of from the ground up, in my opinion. It's organic and it's going to grow in these countries that need it so badly. At the same time that now in the United States, we have the ETFs, which has allowed the institutional adoption of Bitcoin and for them to understand it. It's the first kind of step for investors, institutional investors. We've been doing this for a long time. I've been in the game for 30 years. And so I've seen how difficult it is for people to get their head around fiat currency, the money is broken, and this is something necessary. So this is the next step, and it's an evolutionary process. So it's actually pretty normal, in my opinion.
All right, it's about as beautifully articulated as anybody I've heard. So if you don't mind, I'm going to be stealing and plagiarizing from you, Lavish, in the months ahead. Okay, it's very well put.
And despite the most recent news on inflation not heading where the Fed would like it, Adam Johnson joined me to talk about how bullish he is still on the economy and the market. He believes the market jet still has plenty of fuel left to climb higher. I read the newsletter, I see your notes, and it seems like things are actually looking up. So that's a really good thing for the market. What's your take on the economy right now?
Oh, I think it's a lot stronger than people give it credit for. You know, if you remember, Andrew, you know, it was only a few months ago that everyone was so certain that recession was just inevitable. And I kept saying, no, it's not inevitable. In fact, I don't think it's going to happen. And I'll tell you why. I call it the three E's, earnings, employment, and the economy. The economy is growing somewhere between 2 and 4% GDP growth. That's pretty strong. Meanwhile, we've got just about everyone employed who can work, right? I mean, I remember when I was an economics major down at Princeton, my professor would say, well, full employment is somewhere between 5 and 6%. And now we have learned that full employment is probably somewhere down around 3 to 3.2%. We're around 3.7, 3.8. So a lot of people are working. And when you have people working, they are making money. And when they're making money, they are spending money, which is why you have economic growth. And of course, that translates into earnings growth. So we are now in the middle of the first quarter reporting season. And I think we're going to, by the time it's all said and done, we're only about a fifth of the way through it. By the time it's all said and done, Andrew, I think we're going to find out that growth in the first quarter was 10%. Earnings growth was 10%, which is an acceleration from the fourth quarter of last year. That was at about 7%. And then the third quarter of last year was down around 4. So 4, 7 to 8, and now 10. That's a trend that gets me excited. I'm fully invested. I know I'm the optimist in the room. I almost always am. But there's a lot more to like than not to like, Andrew.
I know it's a subject that drives you crazy because everybody talks about it. And I know that you would wish it would go away, the interest rate question.
Yeah.
And now we're done. I see in your notes, now you're calling for maybe only one decrease this year, as opposed to maybe they'd sneak in a second, but it could be smaller than we expected.
Yeah, what a change. So 4 or 5 months ago, the Fed funds futures market, believe it or not, there's actually a market for what you think the Fed's going to do. In the same way, there's a corn futures market and the oil futures market, et cetera. And that, by the way, is not just for gamblers. It's for hedging. You know, if you have interest rate exposure, you can offset some of that by hedging into the Fed funds futures market. Fine. Several months ago, the Fed fund futures market was predicting 3 rate cuts by June. Here we are, you know, almost to June, and rate cuts are nowhere in sight. And it was forecasting another 3 rate cuts by December. So a total of 6 25 basis point rate cuts, or a total of 1.5 percentage points over the course of the year. And now the Fed fund futures market says we'll get one in December, and maybe we'll get another one in January. So big change. The reason is because inflation kind of started to creep up again, but just as the pendulum always swings too far in one direction and everybody thought that recession was inevitable, and I mean inevitable, and it didn't happen, right now everyone is saying, we're only going to get one rate cut. Hang on, it's still only springtime. We're not even at the halfway point for this year. So I suspect, given that we've had 3 months in a row of slightly rising inflation, that will start to roll back over. Again, I'm the optimist, but there are enough indicators that suggest to me that is likely going to happen in the next couple of months, which means by the time we actually get to October, November, December, chances are the Fed fund futures market will have shifted again. And I think actually it'll shift in consumers' favor, where we have more than just one rate cut, you know, 2, maybe 3.
So what themes, I mean, let's switch gears and talk about investing. What theme, I know you talk a lot about your mentor saying, you know what, pick a theme and go with it. What themes are you looking at in now and into the future?
Well, the obvious one everyone's talking about is artificial intelligence. And you say, how do you get there? Well, fine, you can buy all these big companies like Microsoft, Intel, Google, Facebook. They're obvious because they all have internal AI efforts. But, you know, the building block of AI, what makes it all possible, semiconductors. So yes, NVIDIA. I flagged NVIDIA for my Bullseye subscribers back at 175 2 years ago. My first target was 475. We sold a little. Next target was 675. We sold a little. Next one was 900. Sold a little. My target at this point is 1200. The reason I sell on the way up is, whoop, there goes my phone dropping off my desk, vibrating because people are calling. You know, you have to sell names as they go up. Otherwise, they get too big. And so that's why I've been selling NVIDIA, even though it's a winner. And then you say, okay, fine. What else besides NVIDIA? Oh, all kinds of companies are part of that computing power theme. Marvell Technologies, MRVL, another wonderful AI play that focuses on the databases behind artificial intelligence. You know, think about all the crisscrossing of data that has to happen in order for a computer to generate new intelligence, right? That's generative AI. You're generating new knowledge. That doesn't come, it doesn't come easy. It comes from crunching a tremendous amount of data. You need databases. That's Marvell. There are just so many different aspects to computing. Excellus, ACLS. This company makes machines that embed silicon wafers with ions. Well, again, that's the raw material for creating a semiconductor. So you don't, if you want to play AI, you don't want to just own the big obvious ones like Microsoft and Google. You want to own the raw materials, the picks and shovels, the chips, and the other companies that are responsible for making the components of the chips, and then wiring all this together, the data centers, you know, Prologis, right? I mean, there's so many different aspects to computing power and artificial intelligence. You know, you could have an entire portfolio, you know, 30 names just on that one theme. What about all the derivative users of artificial intelligence, which is ultimately, you know, the story? I'll give you an example. Symbotic, S-Y-M is that ticker. This is a company that is converting all of Walmart's distribution facilities into AI-powered distribution facilities. So it's robotics and it's AI. Really cool stuff, Andrew. The truck pulls up, an automated forklift goes in, unloads it, depalletizes it, meaning takes the pallets apart with all the stuff. Then little robots store all the stuff on shelves, record where it is. And then when the individual stores need more product, a program is just sent back to that distribution facility. And there are 47 distribution facilities around the country that Walmart operates. Then the robots go retrieve all the stuff, build a pallet so that it's weighted correctly. Again, this is all artificial intelligence enabled that, enables that. And then it's loaded onto the truck and the pallets are positioned in a way to optimize weight and stability, again, made possible by artificial intelligence. And then the truck is on its way. So artificial intelligence is something that happens in so many different ways. It's not just a chip. It's not just something happening inside a computer. It's actually happening all around us. And I think every company is going to have to be an AI company.
Many of you have been asking about the current state of the automobile market. So James Conner went out and spoke to YouTube's expert on automobiles, Ray Shefska from CarEdge.
So Ray, let's get into it. I have a real love-hate relationship with dealerships. I love going into the dealership and checking out the new cars, but I hate the whole negotiating process because every time I buy a new car, I feel like I'm getting screwed over. And there's always like 10 or 20 additional charges that I can never make sense of on the invoice. And then they're always pitching you on new services like tire insurance. Why don't you just take us through this whole process and how can I better prepare myself so I'm not getting screwed over?
Just so you know, I have that same love-hate relationship with it. The way it's designed is customers are kind of kept in the dark as to everything that's involved in the sale. And as I like to say, car dealership personnel are some of the most creative people on the planet. And what I mean by that is they can create these visions of you being able to come in and buy something at a particular price until you actually get there. And then that's not really the price. And that's normally where the friction begins. That's typically where the customer goes, damn, I hate dealing with these people. These are not like nice human beings. And it's only because the car business has made it this way. Dealership personnel are trained to turn everybody into what's known as a payment buyer. No, they don't want you to know what you're actually paying for the car. They want you to know and concentrate on what your monthly payment is. And the reason for that is if all you're concentrating on is the monthly payment, then they can manipulate the price. They can manipulate the amount of time that you're paying back that loan. So they can make more money when you're just looking at your monthly payment and not what we like to say, the out-the-door price of the vehicle. What's the selling price of the vehicle, including all fees? And that's the part as a customer you really want to concentrate on, not the payment.
And how can I better prepare myself, though, when I go into a dealership? How can I know what the real price is, or maybe how much the margins is? How much room do I have to negotiate?
You have to figure on most vehicles, there's somewhere between 5 and 10% of margin built into the selling price. Plus, there's some what's known in the industry as under the line money. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's an invoice price that the dealer pays. And then there's money that they get from that invoice price. For instance, there's something called holdback. And holdback is usually 1.5 to 2% of the base MSRP that the dealer collects after they've sold the vehicle. And then there's advertising assistance that the manufacturer pays the dealer. And that can run $500, $600, $700 a car. And dealers don't pay cash for their vehicles. They finance them just like customers do. And that's called floor planning your inventory. Well, the manufacturers give dealers floor plan assistance. That's more money that's under the line. And floor plan assistance can be another $500, $600, $700, $800. So there could be $2,000 of money that dealerships are getting that are below the invoice amount that they actually paid. So what you just always want to concentrate on is the selling price. And if you know there's usually 5 to 10%, if the vehicle has an MSRP of $50,000, well, there's probably close to $5,000 worth of margin. So work on negotiating that $5,000 down to something that's more amenable to both parties.
And Ray, one of the things I'm always debating is whether or not I should buy a car or lease a car. How do I determine what's better for me?
Well, somebody once said, who was much smarter than me, a guy by the name of Getty, had an oil company, a small oil company of some kind. He said, you buy things that appreciate in value, and you lease things that depreciate in value. I can assure you that 99.9% of all the cars out there depreciate in value. So I don't know what the point of trying to own a depreciating asset is. But if you asked me, I lease my cars. I don't buy them because I look at them as a depreciating asset. But it depends on the person and how long you're anticipating keeping the car, how many miles you're planning on driving the car. Leasing doesn't necessarily make sense for all people. My wife, God bless her, when she was alive, she hated the fact that I leased cars. She would look at me and she goes, but at the end of 3 years, we own nothing. Yeah, but we've used this car for 3 years and now we're going to use another brand new car for the next 3 years. But we don't have anything to show for it other than the use of the vehicle. So it depends what your comfort level would be with leasing something as opposed to owning it. Now, realizing that leasing it, typically you can lease a more expensive car for a lower payment than you can financing that car. It just depends on your comfort level with a lease.
Why don't we tie this all into the economy? And maybe you can just provide us with an overview of what's happening in the auto industry in 2024. And just as a reminder, the U.S. economy is growing very strong, 3-4% annualized. The jobless rate is very low. It's been below 4% now for 25 consecutive quarters. So we got a very strong economy. What's happening within the auto industry? Are we seeing strong sales?
Well, yes and no. The sales numbers that get reported seem to indicate growth. But when you dig a little deeper into the numbers, you notice that the sales that have really increased is the percentage of sales that are fleet sales to rental car companies, to governmental fleets, to large fleet buyers. Retail side of things has slowed or even stagnated to a certain degree. And there's two things, in my opinion, that contribute to that. Affordability. If you were to poll most Americans, and they have, 83% said they didn't feel as if they could afford to buy a new car. 83%. Okay, that's a huge number. Who says I can't afford to play in the sandbox anymore? And that's because manufacturers during COVID, with chip shortages and everything else, only wanted to produce high profit margin vehicles, high priced vehicles. And when interest rates were next to nothing, it made it easier for people to be able to buy those. Now, with inflation and interest rates as high as they are, trying to keep an affordable monthly payment has become harder and harder for most people. So even though sales are up, there's fewer people that are actually in the market who feel as if they can afford to be in the market. Here's an interesting stat, at least in my mind. 17.3% of all people in the United States who financed a car last quarter had a payment of $1,000 or more. A monthly payment of $1,000 or more. I make a pretty decent living. I don't have a lot of expense, but I sure as hell couldn't afford $1,000 a month for a car payment.
And then when you throw on fuel, maintenance, insurance.
Exactly.
When it comes to personal finances, many of us are embarrassed or simply won't talk about the debt we find ourselves in. I spoke with Cy from Fireside Chat about his journey out from under $110,000 worth of debt to financial independence, and now his desire to help others do the same. So $110,000 in debt, that had to be a pretty big burden that you carried around with you, I would assume.
Absolutely, yeah. I couldn't sleep for days, and I remember just staying up at night, trying to figure out the numbers. I went to the internet to try to find some resources on how to pay down debt. There was some debt forgiveness, and I didn't tell my family. I didn't tell my coworkers, didn't tell my boss or anybody, because I was really embarrassed by it. So what I realized was that the car loans, those two cars that I didn't need, had to go first, right? So I got rid of them, and that took a lot off my plate, because I got rid of them. I went to the dealership and I said, will you guys just buy these back and I'll take out a difference of the loan? And I did that. And then the next thing I did was really just kind of start budgeting and know what I could do to pay down my credit cards as soon as I could. That was my first thing, the first thing that I had to do to pay down my debt.
Now, you counsel people now. That's what you do, is in your website, Fireside Chat. It's PSY, and that's, you know, people come to you for help now. What do you tell the people that come to you? There, I'm sure there's people that they come to you, obviously, for debt help, financial dependence, and we'll get into FIRE in a few minutes. But what do you tell them when they're so down and they think, you know what, I have to change my life completely? Some of them, yeah, I would assume, don't have to change their life 180. They're just, they need to get out from under for a little while, and then they can have that freedom that you have.
Yeah. Every person's financial situation is different, right? So that's why we call it personal finance, because it's very personal for each one of us, each one of you. I'm sure your personal financial situation is different from mine. Now, when people come to me and say, hey, I need a direction, and that's what they really need, is a direction, right? So I have all these debts, or I have, let's say I have $20,000 that came in and it's just sitting in my bank right now. What should I do with that? Then I tell, you know, I give them the direction and say, here are some options that you can go through. There's option A, there's the Roth IRA, and there is the, you could invest, increase your retirement contributions, or you can move that money out of the traditional bank and put it in a high yield savings account. You know, that's one of the things that I didn't realize, that 82% of Americans don't even know what a high yield savings account was. And they're just putting in a traditional bank that accrues 0.01% in interest. So that's, you know, it's just people in debt or people that have money, they just need a direction, right? And one of my favorite moments is that I have high school seniors come to me and submit their information on my website. And they say, can you just walk me through what a Roth IRA is? You don't need to tell me what to invest. You just tell me how this works. And I said, no problem. I'm not even going to charge you 30 minutes to an hour. Let's go through this. And 18-year-olds, they leave the meeting and knowing that they're going to become multimillionaires in the future. So I'm very hopeful for some of the younger generation. Despite what you read on the news about Gen Z doing this, Gen Z doing that, there are some really incredible and smart Gen Z saving and investing a lot of money. And people who are in debt, like I said, it's just it's a direction, given the tools. I do 20% of the work, they do 80% of everything else.
Let's talk about the FIRE movement a little bit. And that's something that you've gotten into, although FIRE standing for financial dependence, retire early. You're more into the financial independence part, but the retire early part is something that, you know, if people want to do, they can certainly do it. Let's talk about that a little bit and explain to me how you've gotten into that. Obviously, you have a 401k now and, mm-hmm. and a Roth IRA, and that's a vehicle to which people can use to retire early.
Yeah, yeah. So I discovered the FIRE movement during all the readings I was doing when I was paying off my debt, and I found this website. I can't remember the name of it now, but they just call it the FIRE movement. I'm like, what is this about, right? So even on that website, they focus more on the FI than RE. So there's the financial independence and then retire early. I know there are some YouTube channels and there are couples who retire early in their 40s and just living abroad. Some people say, I just want to achieve financial independence so that I have the possibility to retire early. That's where I am. I feel like I have a purpose here, what I'm doing. So I don't want to retire now or in my 40s. I thought about retiring at 45, but now it's more like, no, I just want to be financially independent so I can continue to do what I love to do, what I'm passionate for. And that's really the idea of the FIRE movement, so that you're not stuck at the 9-to-5 workplace doing the job that you don't even like. And you're just going to work every day until you're 60, 67, right? And then you collect your Social Security pension and you're done. FIRE movement is above that. So we don't even consider Social Security pension, right? That is a nice to have, because we are going above and beyond with investing. So when I said that I was really disciplined and I gave up a lot of things during my debt-free journey, I still gave up a few things so that I could continue to pursue my FIRE movement, my FIRE journey. So when I started investing, saving money, I was putting away 25, 30, 45% of my income towards saving. I did that in my first year and I said, that was good, but I didn't have any fun. So I stopped doing that. That was in 2018. I said, you know what? I need to set some cash aside to have fun, because I need to have that balance between life and saving money with the FIRE. So the whole idea was to continue aggressively investing, but at the same time, have a little life for yourself. You're no longer in debt, so that you have the possibility to retire earlier if you want to. Because most people, I can feel it, you know, going into my 40s, I'm not going to be as active as I was in my 20s or 30s. And I want to have the possibility of maybe just call it quits or take a break from my work and just travel the world. That's really the biggest idea.
Without getting personal, where do you suggest people put money away to get the maximum return so it can grow exponentially? So by the time, look, if you're in your 40s, I'm actually in my 50s. So, if I want to retire in 10, 15 years by the age of 70, you know what? I have a couple, I have 10, 20 years left. I want to travel the world. I want to see things that I've never seen before. I have a bucket list just like everybody else. I want to enjoy those things. Where are you telling people to put their money?
So I have like a checklist, right? So coming from the military background, we all use checklists and it's easier for us to understand and follow. What we always prioritize is the getting that 401k match and then do the Roth IRA and then do everything else. Always prioritize your long-term investments first, because if you fail FIRE, let's say you can't retire early, you didn't get to invest as much to retire early, you still have your 401k and Roth IRA. By the time you're 55, you can start collecting your 401k. And then by the time you're 59 and a half, you can still have that money in the Roth IRA. So what I always suggest, and there's a checklist on my website, is that step one, figure out what your annual expenses are right now. And then you can multiply that by with the inflation. And there's a calculator on my website for that too. And then the next step is to get that 401k, but only up to the employer match. That's free money that you're going to get. So you should never leave that out. If your employer gives you a 4% contribution, if you contribute 8%, then the 8% should be the minimum that you do. Then the next step is to have that cash cushion, right? So I teach that and say, you don't want to invest everything you have. You don't want to own everything in cash either, right? You want to have a balance in your net worth. So calculate your net worth and find out where you are, and then build that cushion between you, the cash, and then to investments. So kind of like, you don't want to lay on the floor without a mattress. You get a mattress, that mattress is your cash. So you have that cushion between the floor and where you are with investing. Then the next step would be to max out your Roth IRA, your health savings account. That's another great tool to for the early retirement strategy, is that people are thinking, health savings account, that's just for health, right? No, it's not. You can actually take money out of health savings account early. So if I spend $200 this year on copay, I can reimburse myself 20 years from now from the $200 that I spent in 2024. There's no expiration on it because there's a loophole in the HSA that you can reimburse yourself in the future. And then go after you're done with the 401k, Roth IRA, HSA, that is your long-term retirement plan. Then you move on to start planning for the intermediate or short-term retirement plan. So if you're like 10 years from, I want to retire by age 50 and I'm 40 right now, then you start investing in that 10-year time horizon. If you're within 15 years, then you start investing in that 15-year time horizon. How do people do it? I mean, just opening up a taxable brokerage account, right? So you can go to any brokers that has a taxable brokerage account. And then I don't do anything fancy, index funds, ETFs. I don't do fancy individual stocks. I do a few here and there, but it's not why I'm growing my investments. That's not how my investments are growing. It's mostly from index funds, just really, really boring investments. Once you figure that out, the time horizon and how much money you need to invest every single month to get to that FIRE number is what we call a FIRE number, right? The rule of 25. And you have your annual expenses multiplied by 25. That's how much money you need invested to achieve financial independence.
When it comes to cryptocurrency, some of you have reached out and asked how to go about investing in it. We reached out to our RIA, Windrock, and Brett Rentmeester, explained to us how to get into cryptocurrencies. Now, understanding that you can actually buy things with crypto these days, there are actually some athletes getting paid in crypto, but this is more of an equity at this point. It's not something that I've heard a lot of people say, look, you're not going to go out and buy things with this right now. Eventually, it could come to that. But do you guys look at this more of an equity at this point to grow wealth?
Well, we kind of see it as dual purpose to the point I made earlier. On one hand, at some point, this could be a hedge against a system of fiat currencies running into trouble, whether the dollar, the euro, the yen, et cetera. So it does have that characteristic. We might not be there yet, currently there's still a lot of speculation. It still correlates with equity markets and risk. So the second component of the investment is you're invested in a disruptive technology with a huge network effect that's growing, but it kind of goes through its natural booms and busts.
I have Bitcoin and Solana, Ethereum. I have those all on my iPhone, on my stock charts. I follow them daily to see what they're doing. What do people have to know before they invest? You know, right now, Bitcoin, like I said, around 62,000. Ether, which is on the Ethereum blockchain, in the 3,000 range. Solana, around 130, 140. So that's a big range when it comes to those three. I know there's a bunch of different cryptocurrencies out there other than those three. What does someone need to know before they go and invest? Say, okay, you know what? I'm going to put a chunk of money down on this particular cryptocurrency.
Yeah. Well, let me just give one quick disclaimer as we jump into some of these names that, you know, this is not, you should not be construed as investment advice, and everybody ought to talk to their advisor. Or if they're looking for a like-minded advisor and they like this message, you know, reach out to Windrock. We'll be using some of these coins as examples, not recommendations. So let me start with Bitcoin just out of the gate and then lead to the others. I mean, I think the first thing for people to understand is Bitcoin blockchain is a revolutionary technology. It's not a fad. It's real. Just take Bitcoin, for example. The estimates are hard to get, but if I told you there was something that was able to do over 700 million transactions globally over the last 15 years, and it had no CEO, no employees, no corporation, had never been hacked. Now, individuals have been hacked, wallets and exchanges, but the Bitcoin code has never been hacked. That would seem pretty remarkable, like an ecosystem that's just flourishing on its own. And yet, you know, that's what Bitcoin has done. So that's point number one of what people should know. This is real. It's here to stay. Two, like other technologies, we're going through an adoption curve. So you can go through, you know, your innovators to your early movers to the early majority. And we're probably somewhere approaching the early majority, which you could say is where the internet was in the late 90s. But this technology is moving quicker. And third, if you look at the market capitalization or size of the market, you know, at about 2.3 trillion by some estimates, you know, the whole category would be a top five enterprise in the S&P 500. So the space is getting rather large. And then if you go beyond that, Andrew, before we get into specifics on coins, you've got some countries starting to adopt it. The basket case countries, the ones that have really suffered under hyperinflation and depreciating currencies, El Salvador being maybe the best example. But there's a lot of minefields. I mean, this is still new technology, so it's uncertain. There are a tremendous amount of fraud out there simply because people aren't knowledgeable and they're trying to reach out to others to help them navigate. And the last thing I'll just say that people should understand is there's all sorts of terminology that's complicated. It can range from NFTs to RWAs, real world assets, to DeFi, to a term called HODL, H-O-D-L, which hold on for dear life. The reason that's become a thing in crypto is because there's extreme volatility that the average investor who hasn't been in the space just isn't used to. And so when things are going great, there's this FOMO or fear of missing out. Bitcoin's going to be $1 million. And when things go down, there's this panic selling. So, you know, you wrap all this together. It's real technology. It's here to stay. But it's a complicated, fastly evolving space with a lot of danger that people just have to go in eyes wide open on.
What are the complexities that investing in the choices in investing in crypto?
Yeah, well, there's a couple. There's the vehicles and then there's the coins themselves. So if we could maybe just start with the vehicles. I'd say with the advent of the Bitcoin ETF, and the SEC basically approving it, it's made it a lot easier for the average investor to just go on a Schwab account and buy it. Okay. So that is one way to do it. It's the most simplistic, but it kind of is Bitcoin centric. I'd say the other way, a couple other ways, there still are some vehicles that we refer to as closed end funds, things that own cryptocurrency, but issued a fixed number of shares such that there are times where the price of what they own varies from the price at what you can buy it at. So a good example is Grayscale had some funds and Bitcoin, Ethereum, some of these things were out of favor and you could buy their fund and at one point buy Bitcoin at a 50% discount to what the fund owned. So there are still some opportunities like that today. The third would be we have an ability to go buy direct cryptocurrencies in the name of a client, you know, specific purchases of the kind of names you mentioned. And the fourth, if people are looking for more exotic, more complex things, like I want early stage coins that are launched or NFTs and those kind of things, there are some private funds that are out there.
You talked about coins and cryptocurrency. What are the different coins and what is a coin?
Yeah, well, I'd say, you know, when the space began, it was Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is kind of a monetary experiment. And then the second major coin was Ethereum that you mentioned. And that was kind of the first look at, hey, how do we take blockchain and make it applicable to businesses and be able to do business type things, so-called smart contracts between people and things that will self-execute if certain conditions are met. And that opened up a whole new realm of how blockchain operates. And from there, we've gone down, you know, many verticals that be beyond the scope of today. But things ranging from real life or real world asset kind of applications to decentralized finance, things that used to be done in the banks that can now be done, lending, borrowing, options that can be done in these decentralized exchanges. So, I mean, it's a pretty wide range of applications at this point. And that's part of the issue. There are at least tens of thousands of cryptocurrencies at this point, maybe more. So, and it's changing, it's evolving. It's such a dynamic ecosystem. So it requires staying on top of it. And it's hard for a lot of people to do that. And I think the risk is people kind of chase the hot thing and don't step back and have the right framework on how to approach, you know, the space.
Which, with each different coin using its own blockchain, is there a way for these blockchains to talk to each other? Let's say I invested in Ethereum and right. Someone else is invested in Bitcoin and I want to peer-to-peer purchase something from them. Can these blockchains talk to each other? Or do business with that person?
That's right. Well, yeah, it's a great question. This is very analogous to a lot of technology rollouts historically. Think of cell phones. There was a time where all these little cell phone networks all over, you know, you were traveling and you had to roam because you had AT&T or Verizon, but they didn't talk to the little network in Michigan where you were driving through. So over the years, cell phone networks did exactly what you said. They found a way to connect and be interoperable. That is underway around cryptocurrency. So not perfectly, but there are technologies, there are platforms that are solving that issue. And there are ways to so-called move from one chain, bridge from one chain to another. It's not quite as seamless as it will be in the future, but I think that's the vision for the space.
All right. So let's get back to Windrock. And I come to Brett and I say, I want to buy some Bitcoin. How are you helping me through that? Or I want to buy some cryptocurrency. How are you helping me through that?
Yeah. Well, listen, I think most people come to us looking for an overall strategy, and cryptocurrencies fits, you know, a piece of that strategy. So you start with the big picture and kind of get down based on risk tolerance and a variety of other things to do cryptocurrencies have a fit? And if so, how much? And then, you know, it is about the individual. The simple solution is, sure, go buy the Bitcoin ETM at Fidelity or Schwab. That's the easy solution, but not always the best. I mean, there are ways to own it directly, which, again, I gave you the example of the hardcore crypto people want to own it directly in their own private wallet or custody. Nobody else should. People can still do that, but you've got to be tech savvy and make sure you don't make a mistake or lose your password or your keys, so-called keys, or you're in trouble. So a lot of people don't feel like they're at that level. They want to be in the system, but they probably want to do something a little more than just owning the Bitcoin ETF. So that's where a typical client might own some of these funds that are trading at a discount. And if they have enough money that they want to put in the space, we might open an account where we're buying individual cryptocurrencies in their name through a third-party custodian, but held in private wallets for security for that client. So it could be, you know, that whole range of options.
Thanks again for watching the weekly market recap here on Wealthion. If you need help being financially resilient, please head over to Wealthion.com and sign up for a free, no obligation consultation with one of our registered investment advisors. And remember to follow us on social media for the latest news and information to help you invest wisely. And if you could like and subscribe to the channel, we greatly appreciate it. Don't forget to hit the notification bell so you can find out when we post new videos to the channel. Thanks again for watching, and until next time, stay informed, be empowered, and may your investments flourish. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you.